Welcome to Frontline, the podcast talking about the issues affecting health, social and community workers in the UK. We're here to talk about the topics important to you and give insight on tackling the professional dilemmas which might be affecting you day to day. Hello and welcome to Frontline. My name is Chris Slater.
And I'm Dave Gill.
And welcome to our first ever podcast. Dave, how are you feeling?
I'm excited for our first podcast. Being something that people find useful. What about yourself?
Yeah, feeling good. I think this is a really good opportunity to put something out there that a lot of people may not have heard of. So just before we get cracking on this week's topic, what can we expect from the series?
Well, each pod, what we're aiming to do is bring up a topic, something that you may be aware of, something that may impact on your work, or something you might not be aware of. The idea is to explore it, have a bit of discussion around it, maybe bring up some relevant facts, and hopefully by the end of the podcast, you might be even taking away some tips.
We have you in mind when we obviously do these shows, so we really want to be hearing from you.
At the end of the episode as well, we're going to give you all the different ways that you can get in touch through email or through Twitter, or even tracking us down and grabbing us on the street and telling us you want to be involved.
Hopefully it won't come to that, but you never know, we might catch fire very quickly. We just don't know. We're talking today about spice. So, Dave, before we delve down into this, what do we mean when we use the term spice? What is it?
It's interesting that spice has kind of become the term that's stuck, because actually the technical term for spice is what we call synthetic cannabinoid receptor agonists.
So we are talking essentially about a group of drugs?
Yes. It's interesting you say group there, because when we are talking about spice, we are talking about potentially 250 different strains of synthetic cannabinoid receptor agonists.
250, that's a massive number. I mean, could it potentially be even larger than that?
It's a conservative estimate. This is what we're basing on what we call our European monitoring system, where we've physically been able to find different strains and log them. But potentially, there could be others out there, or there could be others that haven't yet been discovered.
We've mentioned before they are synthetic cannabinoids. Where on earth did they come from?
So you hear the term synthetic cannabinoids and you automatically hear cannabinoids and think of?
Cannabis.
So what cannabinoids do is they work on your cannabinoid receptors in your brains. They activate them, and our cannabinoid receptors are wonderful things anyway in our brain because it helps us with our pain killing. However, cannabis and synthetic cannabinoids bind to those receptors and produce different effects. Because they both bind to the cannabinoid receptors, though, doesn't mean they are the same thing.
You mentioned different effects. So are we talking about the same kind of effects, or are we talking about completely different effects altogether?
Well, this is one of the problems we're having with the 250 plus strains, because some of the strains will have similar sort of effects to cannabis. But the majority of strains that we know of actually have stronger effects. I think one of the reports I once read said it was 750% stronger than street cannabis, which is just remarkable. And how that happens is it just binds a lot stronger to your cannabinoid receptors in your brain, particularly because what the synthetic cannabinoid receptor agonists are trying to do is create a synthetic form of THC, the stuff that gets you high in cannabis. Although what natural cannabis has is something called CBD, which brings you down. When you are creating synthetic cannabinoids, you're not too fussed about the CBD because it's the THC, or the synthetic version of it, that you're trying to sell and market.
The word that keeps coming up from what you've been saying is synthetic synthesis. So where did it come from? Where was it being synthesized originally?
Okay, well, for this, we have to think about the 20th century as a massive step forward in our understanding of chemistry, medications. And throughout the 20th century, we've been creating, synthesizing loads of different drugs based on what was already out there. The idea is we were trying to create miracle drugs or miracle medications that could do wonderful things. And as people discovered them, they just got logged in a chemistry book and forgotten about. For example, MDMA, known as ecstasy, first synthesized in 1912. You wouldn't think about that, would you?
No, I didn't realise it was that long ago, actually.
Exactly. But because these things get synthesised fairly early, people don't quite know what to do with them. They get logged away somewhere. And only years later do they get rediscovered and used recreationally. And then this is where we get addictions and so on. So throughout the 20th century, various different things were happening. It was only in the 1980s experiments were happening around trying to create synthetic cannabinoids, hoping that by activating your cannabinoid receptors in your brain, you could create maybe a miracle drug. Never quite happened, but there were chemistry books filled of recipes of synthetic cannabinoids.
Really, we're talking about something that was designed to be a benefit to people, something that could have been the ultimate painkiller, essentially, it's been perverted into something quite different.
Yeah, so what started to appear in the 1990s was something called head shops, where people could sell paraphernalia, drug paraphernalia and other things, you know, maybe go in and buy bongs for cannabis and other things. So it was very drug-related shops without actually selling the drugs itself, but you sold everything with it. Kind of skirted the law. So within these, we started to first see people selling what was called at the time legal highs.
So hang on a minute. I could go down my high street sometime in the mid-90s and just walk in and buy this.
This is when it first started to appear, so it was very hard to do so. I mean, the ability to walk into a shop and buy it started to happen in the, I'd say, the early 2000s. That's when it started to gather momentum. One of the reasons for this is our UK drug laws were written in the 60s and 70s, when it was felt that all the illicit drugs that existed, there wouldn't be any more coming onto the scene. People just used heroin, crack, cocaine, ecstasy, etc., and that was it. And we also had, in particular, an act called the Medicines Act 1968, which said you cannot sell something as a drug. What happened was, by synthesising new drugs, it didn't fit into the classification. It wasn't a Class A, B or C, but you couldn't sell it as a drug. So what you had to do was to get around the Medicines Act, was start to sell stuff not for human consumption and sell it as a herbal incense. Or maybe if it was a powder, sell it as a research chemical. Your idea was you were looking at the UK drug law saying, prove to me I'm doing something illegal.
As long as you didn't market it a certain way, it was totally fine to sell this quite happily and legally.
Yeah. You are just, like you say, it's cat and mouse game. You were saying to the UK drug laws, prove to me I'm not selling this as a drug. What would happen is the UK drug laws would gather momentum, realise maybe the damages that could be caused by this, and ban it. When that happened, all you would do is go, fine, fair enough, I will just tweak my chemical structure and create something slightly different, but a new drug, and therefore I could sell that, and the whole cat and mouse thing would start again.
So we've established that there were ways of working around how you could actually sell this to people, literally in broad daylight on the high street. Who were these drugs being marketed to?
Originally, they were aimed at young people as a safe, and I put that in brackets, or safer alternative to cannabis. Hence why the term spice came about, these bright packets came about, they were marketed and aimed at young people.
Hang on a minute. Just to clarify that point a little bit more, when you say safer, I mean, how can that be safer than ordinary cannabis? Why were people thinking that it was a safer alternative?
We know now it wasn't safe. It wasn't safer. What people were doing was seeing the fact that they could buy these in a shop and take them home and smoke them, do whatever they wanted with them. They felt because they could do that, it was a safer alternative. It's that perception in your head going, well, I can go into a shop and buy this. This must be safer than the stuff that I have to go to the drug dealer for.
People were assuming there was some kind of regulation or kite mark.
Exactly, exactly. People thought, because you could buy it in the shop, the government would not allow you to buy a drug. But the reality was so different because the government just didn't have a clue what to do. But at this point, young people, parents, teachers were having the attitude of at least it wasn't illegal drugs. The only good thing from this was a lot of young people at the time rejected these pretty quickly because they did not like the effects they were getting and quickly moved either away from it or back to things like cannabis because they thought, at least I know what I'm getting with that.
Was that because the effects were so extreme?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The effects were extreme, wide-ranging. They were getting effects they were not expecting, such as cannabis. They were expecting to be chilled and stoned, and they were getting extreme heart palpitations, passing out. They weren't getting what they hoped for.
Are there any other kind of effects that people should know about?
When people use them, you know, you're talking such extreme effects, it can bind to your cannabinoid receptors so strongly that it can force people to pass out very quickly. Wide-ranging effects, heightened emotions, heart palpitations, organ failure, blood pressure failure. You're talking psychotic episodes, you're talking complete cognitive shutdown, hence why in the press we talk about the zombie drug. Huge, huge host of different effects. And because you were talking about 250 plus different strains, it's hard to do any sort of particular controlled studies on what this does to you because you'd need to isolate one of the strains, get it in a lab and really look at it. But because people are using different strains, it's hard to understand.
So it's highly unpredictable in terms of how it's actually going to affect the user.
Yeah.
But yet readily accessible and legal to buy.
Yes. And this all changed in 2016. But interestingly, about 2009, I went to Glastonbury. And I remember being stood in the queue to go in. And there was drug sniffer dogs. You know, the security guards that were going through every single bag with like pills, powders in, saying no cocaine, no ecstasy. you know, really, really strict on drugs. And I remember we got through and there was a stall selling legal highs. So you could go and buy things like methadrone, which is called MCAT, now a Class B stimulant drug, but you could go and buy it after you went through that whole rigmarole of having all these so-called illegal, more dangerous drugs, and you'd suddenly go and buy these so-called legal highs. It was a crazy, crazy time.
Surely that's a complete contradiction in terms. You've got people who are literally confiscating what is deemed to be, you know, a psychoactive substance right on the front gate, but yet as soon as you pass that point, you could actually buy something that could even give you more extreme effects.
It just shows human behaviour and human understanding. Because these drugs were not controlled under any act and not deemed to be illegal, people just had the misconception that it was safe. So this cat and mouse game was going on and on and on. We saw the biggest change approximately 3 years ago when the Psychoactive Substances Act came out in May 2016.
So tell us a bit about that. What happened exactly?
So the government felt that this cat and mouse, banning a substance and then someone coming along, tweaking it, changing something, wasn't working. So they created a separate piece of legislation called the Psychoactive Substances Act that basically said if you create something that could produce a psychoactive effect, it is banned. So that meant that it was a blanket ban for any so-called legal high on new psychoactive substance, banning everything under this act. So if you weren't a Class A, Class B or Class C or an exempted substance like alcohol or nicotine, everything else fell into this, which meant the people selling this through these head shops or even through online websites had to be shut down if you were based in the UK.
So that was the knock-on effect. People were shut down.
Yes.
So the accessibility was cut off.
Absolutely.
So that was quite a rigorous implementation of that new legislation. It shut down the ability to pop down to my local high street and just obtain this legally. So surely, as a result of that, does that not just drive the market underground?
And that's exactly what we've seen, because what was happening during this time as well, particularly from, say, about 2011 to about 2015-16, was the young people had started to reject it. This safer alternative cannabis, people were moving away from it. But it was starting to find a market in other areas. In particular, it started to find its way into prisons because you could get it through relatively easy. You didn't need to worry about sniffer dogs. You could send it in. It was a lack of understanding, again, which allowed it. And once something is in a prison, it's very, very hard to regulate and control. It was cheap, it was accessible, and it was also powerful, and it also started to find its way into vulnerability groups, such as people who are street homeless and people who already use drugs.
You mentioned a couple of times now that it's actually very, very difficult to detect with conventional means, sniffer dogs being the prime example. Is there a way to actually detect it?
Yeah, I mean, sniffer dogs can be trained, drug testing can be utilised, but you've got to remember when these things were coming onto the scene, no sniffer dogs were trained, no drug testing kits were designed to pick this up. So it's like anything, by the time we've figured out what to do, it's already there. It's already affecting the most vulnerable people.
It's insidious, it's ingrained itself.
Absolutely. And so everything we are doing now to support and help people, we are playing catch-up.
Now, are we being more reactionary?
I would say so. I think our response, since the Act, it was deemed to hopefully stop it, it hasn't. So now everything is just reactionary. Whether you are a frontline service in the community or working in a prison, unfortunately, the default line has been, let's just react.
Just to summarise what we've established so far, it's a highly unpredictable and highly addictive substance. It's been able to be sold freely and legally for a very, very long period of time. It's ingrained itself into society, especially amongst the most vulnerable people. I think the best thing to do now is to look at how that is providing the challenge for the people who are actually dealing with this day to day. Before we drill down into the challenges that Spice is presenting to frontline workers, we touched upon this very briefly earlier on about the actual effects of it. Obviously, the effects are very extreme, they're very unpredictable, but the word zombie was used before. Now, I've seen various articles where people who have been affected by Spice have been referred to as zombies. So what is that actually doing to our perception of the people who have been affected by it?
It's an interesting technique to utilise. What it basically does is it dehumanises the person who's using it. It's a way for us to look at the pictures online or maybe in a newspaper and go, look at that person, look how different they are to me. And unfortunately, it's been used many years. I mean, when there is a new drug trend, this is a classic technique that we tend to do in our society, is we demonise and dehumanise these people by saying, look how different they are.
How has that impacted on the services that these people have been able to access or receive?
Again, I think it's just feeding into the fear that people see this, whether you're a professional or not. But I mean, in particular, if you're a professional, you see this. And again, it's heightening your anxiety. It's heightening your fear of, I hope this person doesn't walk into our service because I don't feel equipped to support this person. It's about that fear of, I can't do enough.
Let's talk about that. So that's actually a really good place to start, the kind of challenges that this is really presenting for people who are involved in frontline services. Perhaps people don't feel necessarily informed or equipped enough to deal with this kind of situation, especially when the effects of spice can be so unpredictable and volatile. How can we go about tackling that?
When you're thinking about spice use, we need to be thinking it from, I guess, two perspectives. Firstly, the crisis perspective, the idea that someone walks in, is massively under the influence, potentially these zombie-like effects, and maybe even passing out. And the second approach is the long-term support that person needs. So they're not in crisis, but they're still telling you, I have an addiction to this drug and I need support.
So how can these methods better equip frontline workers?
If we think about it in terms of someone coming in crisis, I think one of the key things to think about is safety. Your safety and the other person's safety and the people around you's safety as well. And I think if you look at it from that perspective, you can be thinking, how can I keep that person safe? What can I do to help this person? What can I do to keep myself safe if this person is being unpredictable, maybe being violent? I would suggest if you're in a position, if you feel confident and competent enough to look at it and go, what's happening here? What can I do with this situation? How can I help this person? Can I maybe take this person to one side, sit them down, talk to them, look after them, and see if I can get any sort of response out of this person? If at any point you don't feel confident, there is no shame in that. What you should be doing is looking after yourself and looking after that person by going, I think this person could do with an ambulance. I am not a trained healthcare professional. I shouldn't be worrying too much about whether I should or shouldn't. If in doubt, keep yourself and that other person safe and give them a call. If we are talking about the other side of it, the long-term support, my advice would be to think about the presenting symptoms. What are they asking you? How can you respond? How can you help that person? It's the same with any problem. Someone comes to you saying, I have this problem, a heroin problem. How would you respond?
Now, of course, an unfortunate side to all of this is that a lot of it can come down to additional training, which in the grander scheme of things means a giant, great, big, stonking pound sign. Assuming that resources are limited, which as we know they most certainly are in a lot of services up and down the country, how can frontline workers actually do more to tackle this with very limited resources at their disposal?
Well, I think if we're talking about the crisis point of view, best response can be what we call symptomatic responses. As I've kind of touched upon earlier on, it's a case of what do you see? How do you act? So, for example, if I'm trying to help someone and that person has passed out, what can I do to help this person? I.e. put them in a recovery position, call an ambulance. If we are talking about the other stuff, then it's a case of thinking, how do you currently respond? What do you normally do if someone comes to you and says, I need help? Rather than getting fixated on they may be using spice to a point where it can make you feel de-skilled and worried and concerned because I cannot handle that, think about what is within your power. What do you have at your disposal that you can help people with? So if that person comes to you and you're a drugs worker, you think, right, well, I know how to help people make the changes. I will do that. If you're not a drugs worker, think about creating those safe, positive relationships with that person.
What you're saying is that it's a much more universal approach that you might need to take, especially if you've not encountered this before or indeed not encountered it to this kind of extent. Really, should we be thinking about spice separately or should we be thinking about it in terms of how we deal with other drug problems?
For me, I think how we've been seeing spice and other new psychoactive substances, anything that's kind of gather momentum and found a market in the last 10-15 years, such as methadone or synthetic cannabinoids, we have seen them as separate. Hence the terms legal highs or new psychoactive substances. We've created separate boxes, separate labels for these drugs. And all that has done is it's created anxiety and fear for people out there. When in fact, if we stop seeing them as such and just accept that these are powerful drugs which are causing people harm, either short-term or long-term, then what do we do? How do we respond? Because again, when we are thinking the long-term addiction side of things, drugs aren't really the problem. They're usually the solution to other problems.
Indeed. And just going down that road a little bit further, you mentioned there that they are the solution to other problems. So in your opinion, in the ideal world, how could services work together to tackle this?
Well, you've got to look at who's accepting responsibility for trying to help people. And I think at the minute, people are a little bit confused about who should be taking the responsibility. because you would look at it and go, well, people are using drugs, therefore should the drug service not be dealing with this? However, we know that the most vulnerable people are prison leavers and people who are street homeless who are using this. So should the prison service, probation service be involved? Should housing services, homelessness services, outreach workers be involved? What about the local authority? They have a role to play in this. Should they not be involved? What about the police? Because they've got to police the Psychoactive Substances Act as well. So actually, the more you drill down into it, there isn't a simple service that should be taking the lead on this. There should be everyone getting involved. From my experience, what I've seen is the areas that seem to be tackling this the best are the ones where one service, one voice, takes the lead and goes, you know what? We might not be the lead for this, but we're going to grab people together. We're going to get people around the table and see what sort of solution we can get out of this.
Yeah, so it's bringing people together on a united front, essentially.
I think, again, when something new like this happens, it's very easy for us to go, not my problem. Or it's very easy for us to go, I'm scared, I don't know how to deal with this, I'll just hope it disappears. And that usually happens with new drug trends. We kind of go, ooh, I hope it's going to disappear. But I think it's showing us now that it's not disappearing, it's got some legs.
Obviously, Spice has been around for many, many years.
Yes.
It's clearly not going to go anywhere. It's clearly ingrained itself.
Mm.
So really, going forward, what's the best way to tackle it?
Well, as we were just saying, it's that multi-agency approach. I think if someone in a community is willing to take the lead on this, say we're the outreach team, we need to call a multi-agency meeting, we get everyone around the table and think about what we need to do. The hope is that the local authority realises that the impact that this can have and maybe free up a bit of funding so that we can do something about it, tackle it, whether it's through training, understanding, it's through working with those people who are perhaps addicted to Spice and not necessarily getting help at the minute.
So we've established what we would do in the ideal scenario, but has there actually been any real examples of this happening?
Well, the best example I've seen over the last few years has been in Wrexham in North Wales, where what they identified was that it was a health issue. And I think this is one of the interesting elements. When you stop seeing it as a criminal issue, you are using drugs, it's criminal, we should send you to a prison, and start to see it as a health problem, which is about, I'm seeing that person as a human being, vulnerable, maybe had a history of complex trauma, I can help that person and do something with it. So the model that Wrexham have utilised is they've got people together, including the police, including the local authority, homelessness services, housing, drugs and alcohol services, and they've gone in, tackled the most vulnerable people who they've identified with using it.
What's interesting about what you've just said there is that they, in North Wales, have not seen it as a drug problem. They've seen it as a health problem.
Yeah, because one of the ways that they got the buy-in from services was that they identified this cohort of individuals who were using Spice in the town centre. They were responsible for massive amounts of 999 call-outs, both police and paramedics, general antisocial behaviour. They weren't accessing services or they were dropping out. So what they did was they came together, created a list of these people and tried to tackle them head on. And they went to each individual and basically said, what do you need for help? What can I do to help you? What is it that you need right here, right now? They had funding, they had buy-in. The idea is just getting someone quickly. What do you need? Rehab, housing, relationship support, whatever it is. What can we get you quickly to get you out of this situation?
Tackling a root cause, essentially.
And what this did was it allowed people who wanted to see it from a human side, i.e. the frontline workers, the services, the charities, who wanted to help people, they got what they needed, which was to truly help people and support. Who chose not to see the human element, there was a cost saving as well, because by tackling these people, not physically going along rugby tackling, by tackling...
I certainly hope not.
Yeah, no. By actually going in and supporting and helping these people, it meant that for a cost up front, meant over time, 999 call-outs would be reduced, antisocial behaviour would be reduced, in and out of services would be reduced. The most vulnerable caught up in it were able to get support, were able to be moved on and access treatment, accessing services. It's not to say that that was a miracle cure that stopped everything, but for me, it was a starting point. And it allowed the people there to tackle this head on and get talking about it, which for me is one of the key elements of this.
So that example in Wrexham is, in your opinion, the template of a good way of tackling it.
Even if you don't have a Spice strategy in place, if you have a strategy to work with vulnerable people, the byproduct of that is the people who use Spice will be naturally impacted on positively anyway.
We need to be taking more of a human approach.
Yes, simple as that.
So going forward in the next, say, 5-10 years, assuming that we carry along the path that we're carrying along and that more people can learn from Wrexham's example, where do you see this actually going?
We need to be taking what we class as a harm reduction method, which is about keeping people safe. And harm reduction, its most basic principles, is about keeping that person safe and keeping them alive. But also really building into it, into services, drug services in particular, about being aware of new drug trends. However, the critique of this is it's still very vague. You need to be aware. But most people would come back with, well, what advice do we have?
I fear I may be opening Pandora's box by asking this question, but I will do it anyway, because we've mentioned before, you mentioned just there, actually, drugs trends. So it's obviously an ever-evolving issue. And going back to just taking the template example as well, if we were to flip that over and take the darker side of a template, so obviously spice in itself has had its own kind of lifespan, as it were, up until this point. We've been charting its evolution right from inception to where we are today in 2019. Is there a danger there are other drugs that are going to start going along the same kind of route as spices? Because at the end of the day, like we mentioned earlier, it's synthetically created.
If you've got a society like ours that has criminalised drugs, but we know for thousands, millions of years, human beings have always used drugs, people will always find a way to sell drugs because people want it. It's the basic principles of supply and demand. Yeah. Unfortunately, that will always be there. And because that will always be there, there will always be criminal networks and gangs and drug dealers who will exploit this. And because spice is accessible, cheap to produce, cheap to get out there, but it can make you money, you will always find people that are willing to do that. And even if spice drops off, there will be something else that comes onto the scene. So I think rather than be too worried about whether it's spice or whether it's something else, it's more about thinking, how do we respond in general? What is our approach to drugs? And I think any movement towards more of a health response rather than a criminal response will be the best way.
Or even just tackling the reasons why people feel inclined to use drugs in the first place.
Most people don't wake up one morning and go, I want to be addicted to drugs. Most people who use drugs in this world use them recreationally. It's only a small amount of people who use them due to addiction. And usually that addiction has come about due to physical or mental pain. Trying to understand what that physical and mental pain is, where it's come from, and how can we tackle it will mean long-term change.
Now time for Quick Shot. 5 questions, 5 answers in less than 30 seconds. Why is this important?
Because it is a drug trend and it's affecting a lot of people.
What are the key areas?
Spice is an umbrella term for something called synthetic cannabinoid receptor agonist, so expect wildly different effects.
What can you do as a frontline worker?
Provide harm reduction. If in doubt, call an ambulance. If you're a drugs worker, use the same tools and techniques you've always used.
What should you avoid?
It's thinking that this is not a drug problem and treating it as something different.
What will this mean for the future?
Whatever comes around the corner, we can use the same techniques.
Well, we're almost out of time today, but just to summarise what we've learned from today's episode, certainly from my point of view, I was always aware of spice as a concept, but I didn't realise just the sheer extent of it, not just in the fact that it's an umbrella term for a whole group of drugs, but indeed because it's not a singular drug, it's also not a singular problem. It's really just the tip of the iceberg in masking a lot of other issues that we need to be aware of. There's obviously a lot of work to do, but I think one thing that is positive that we can take from this is that we need to be a lot more adaptable in our approach, not just to this, but any other kind of problem like it. We need to be taking much more of a human perspective to it all.
All I'd add to that is keep that person safe and keep yourself safe. Call an ambulance if need be. Flip side of that, if that person wants support and they're not in crisis, my advice would be to just figure out why they're doing it. What is going on for them in their life? Rather than be so fixated on the spice use itself, think about what is happening in that person's life and what is within your power to help them.
And of course, if you would like to find out more about spice and the effects of spice, please go on to the Risk and Resilience website. Dave, what's the address?
www.risk-and-resilience.co.uk.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time for this episode, but join us next time for our next topic, which is going to be psychologically informed environments. In the meantime, I've been Chris Slater.
And I've been Dave Gill.
This is Frontline. Remember, this show is designed around you, so be sure to subscribe from wherever you get your podcasts. Our email is frontline@risk-and-resilience.co.uk or follow us at frontlinepod.